They say the American dream is a house with a car in the driveway and a white picket fence. The first house that we had in America was in Sylvania Township, a small bungalow made of industrial bricks, bad insulation, old windows, and ivy, not the good kind, with little suckers that pulled back the white paint every summer. The funny thing about this house was how it was sited. The front of it faced a busy four-lane road. Cars zoomed by at a 50-mile-per-hour pace. We never got around to covering the front windows, so every evening if you drove by, you'd probably see what we were having for dinner. But the back of the house was totally different. It was about an acre of land flanked on three sides, with tall, probably ancient trees. My favorite specimen was a giant willow, a bit worse for wear, that leaned in from the northwest corner. It felt a bit magical to come home off of a squeaky school bus and be able to walk straight into a private, shaded forest clearing. In the summer, my dad taught me how to mow the property with a lawnmower he fixed up. In the fall, we raked leaves. And every winter, you'd see a huge pile of wood in our backyard. A family friend would dump a box truck load of timber there every season. To save on heating costs, we used a steel wood burner stove with a fan attachment to blow out the hot air. We'd have a series of box fans throughout the house to try to circulate the heat to the second and third floors. I'd often wake up in the middle of the night to see my mom and dad loading fresh timber to keep us warm. And then in the spring, my favorite season, I watched our Midwest greenery come back to life. We did all kinds of things. My dad and I even planted a maple sapling in the front yard one season. Then one day, my dad started digging up around the hedges in the back. He was always working on a project with me. Long story short, he had gotten a tarp and a few pond gadgets. A few hours later, we had a small pond, which we filled with those 10-cent goldfish from the pet store. Soon enough, those little guys grew and outpaced the pond we had built for them, which I suppose is kind of a good metaphor for us and that house. We left behind that house and moved into a different neighborhood as I moved on to high school. I still drive by it often. It does have a white picket fence around it now. And although those looming trees, which were my childhood playground, have since been cut down, the memories of making a wild acre into our own home have stuck with me to this day. Oh, and that tree that we planted? It's now over 50 feet tall. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. I'm your host, Samuel Chang. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home, and likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the fifth episode of Midstory's brand new podcast, Brain Drain, to take a deep dive into the difficult and complex decision to leave home, or likewise, to stay. Next up is a story about a movement that aims to connect America through turning unused railroad tracks into recreational trails. Finally, hear what residents of Mill Creek, a watershed just outside of Cleveland, are doing to reconnect with this forgotten natural treasure. It's no secret that post-industrial cities like Toledo are struggling with depopulation. What are the reasons people leave? And what would convince them to stay? To answer these questions, we interviewed dozens of Toledoans, people who've left, people who've stayed, and everyone in between. Today, we're bringing you the next episode of Brain Drain, a new series from the team at MidStory. It's a podcast 7 years in the making and at the core of why we came home. Episode 5 explores the cultural and natural landscapes of cities like Toledo, Ohio, that have led some to see the city in a new light and even to make it home. Learn more about this podcast, explore data visuals, and tune in to future episodes at www.midstory.org/braindrain.
And if you can all rise and remove your caps, we're going to play national anthem.
Oh, yeah. Stand up.
It's 5 o'clock on a sultry Saturday afternoon at the Lucas County Fairgrounds on the outskirts of Toledo, Ohio. You heard that right. We're at a demo derby.
3, 2, 1, let's get it!
Bumper cars.
Today we're here to see the demolition derby. Excited for the demolition derby.
Yes. Could you give me your full name and then like spell it out, please?
Ronnie Broadway, RONNIEBROADWAY.
Oh, like the street.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes.
Do you like Broadway shows? That's not relevant, just curious.
I mean, I like Hamilton.
Real. How long have you lived in Toledo? Do you live in Toledo?
Yeah, I've lived here my whole life.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm 18. I've lived here since I was born.
And what do you think of like availability of like recreational activities, especially because you're like 18, young adult?
Well, there's plenty of things to do. We got one of the best zoos in America.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I love the zoo. I like to bowl. Love bowling. Playing trampoline parks, go-karting, random stuff like that.
Stuff like that. Contrary to popular belief, Midwest cities do have more to offer than demo derbies and livestock auctions. Although, we went to both and had a great time. A real cultural experience. But ask any Toledoan what makes Toledo great, and there's a standard list.
We are always going to the zoo, to the metro parks, the new Glass City Park downtown.
We go to Lucas County Fair, we go to Mud Hens games. You know, sort of like whatever was around, going watching the fireworks, sitting on the bridge, and just hanging out with family mostly. So there was definitely, and the zoo. My God, we love the zoo.
Yeah, we like it here. We like the park systems too. The park systems are fantastic. We actually got married in one of the park systems.
We did.
Which was super cool. We got married at the Manor.
Toledo isn't short on amenities. And that, coupled with the low cost of living, makes it, in theory, the perfect place for any young person to build the life they want to live. But as we've heard throughout this season, many young people aren't satisfied with ease and comfort. If it's a search for adventure that has led them away from Toledo, how could this city transform to provide that spark and excitement that so many bright young minds are hungry for? Or is it enough that one day, those very same people might find themselves looking for what Toledo already offers? Welcome to Brain Drain, a brand new Midstory production that presents the city of Toledo through the eyes of the people who've left it behind. I'm Yannick Schaller. Episode 5. I'm after whatever the other life brings. Ayendi Bonifacio didn't grow up going to demo derbies and livestock auctions. He didn't grow up going to world-class zoos and metro parks either.
I was born in the Dominican Republic, a small farm town called Juncalito. So for the first decade of my life, you know, home was going back home to the Dominican Republic, and particularly to that small town, that small rural farm town where my family had been cultivating coffee beans for over 250 years. My sense of home was always tethered to that farm town.
Allende's family moved to New York City, where Allende spent most of his childhood.
As I got older, as I became a teenager, as I learned how to live and survive in Brooklyn, East New York, you know, my sense of home shifted a little bit. And home then became the street I grew up on, Sunnyside Avenue in East New York, Brooklyn. And the, you know, my friends, the people who made me feel safe, who made me feel loved, who made me feel seen on the block. That became home.
Allende eventually went on to do his PhD at The Ohio State University.
I experienced a sort of culture shock when I moved to Columbus because I immediately felt other there. And it wasn't just that I felt that I didn't belong. I felt like I was away from home in, I guess, in the most exaggerated way possible. It was then that home began to feel like it was somewhere in the East Coast, whether that was Pennsylvania or like Connecticut or Vermont or places I've never been. That sort of, I always had this gravitational pull towards the East. I needed to find my way back. I remember there one person asked me like, where are you from? I know you're not from here. Like, you know, so that there I felt like that my place was imposed upon me. Like, okay, clearly I'm not from here. I have a sort of accent, right? It's not that I have just a Spanish accent. It's like a geographical, like New York or East Coast kind of accent. And that was clear. It felt like it was missing the things I expected from a big city, right? In terms of culture, in terms of people, in terms of language, in terms of experiences, in terms of class stratification. I just expected that feeling, right? I remember going downtown and thinking, why is downtown deserted?
Some of Midstory's interns had the same feeling when they arrived in Ohio.
Hello.
That's Anavi Prakash.
I am a rising junior at Northwestern University studying journalism and social policy. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, so also in the Midwest. And my first impression of Toledo was when I was driving in from the airport and everything just seemed like brick boxes lining the streets. I don't know, I wasn't used to seeing everything so close together, yet it almost felt like everything was also so far away.
Anavi spent her summer talking to Toledoans about the place they call home, finding out what people think is missing from their city.
What is it that you're going to focus on today?
So this episode looks at the sense of adventure or the lack of it in places like Toledo and elsewhere in the Midwest for young people specifically. They want to go anywhere else to kind of find some vibrance is a word that was used a lot in their lives. But at the same time, as they get older, they come back to visit Toledo, see the city through fresh eyes, and they find this comfort, this familiarity that for some people actually makes them want to stay.
The research tells us a lot of things. They tell us, one, that young people just want to try new things, right? And I think that that's innate in us as people, as humans. And we want to exert our independence. I think that's also part of it, right? Like leaving the nest, quite literally, in a lot of ways. And I think that that's actually super valuable. I think that's important. I think that that is how we have, as a species, accomplished so many of the things that we have. People were willing to leave and go and try and seek new things and find new things.
That's Dr. Nicole Pfeiffer, the director of the Center for Regional Development at Bowling Green State University. She grew up in Northwest Ohio, but eventually left for education and career building elsewhere. Now, she's back and helping lead the charge for talent retention.
This is a controversial opinion, but I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing in that when young people have the opportunity to leave, go seek the things that they are seeking to see and find, you know, look at different perspectives and see different places, and then come back home and look at the community with fresh eyes, sometimes you can see the things that you didn't see before.
I don't blame people for wanting to go out and experience a place that has more options of things to do. I grew up in Sylvania, so I think I thought like the whole universe was Sylvania. And, you know, that is a lovely community, but it's very family oriented.
Meet Molly Lutke, a Toledo resident who isn't shy about her love for the city. After growing up in the nearby suburb of Sylvania, she moved to Toledo after college and quickly found a group of people who keep her social calendar stacked and give her a strong feeling of fulfillment. But in many ways, Molly is the exception. Other residents we spoke to expressed deep frustrations with Toledo, describing it as a difficult place to find like-minded individuals and engaging activities.
My oldest niece, who's the closest to going to college, like, absolutely doesn't believe that she wants to live in Toledo. You know, she doesn't want to come back here.
The folks that are happiest with the city tend to point to its affordability and family-friendly atmosphere. But those people are often raising families of their own. They fit right in. Molly and her niece don't.
She has a similar experience, which is she's growing up in a suburb in a very traditional community where almost everybody is married with multiple children, sending their kids to school and showing up on soccer games on Saturday, and living a really lovely life, but it's one specific way of living a life, right?
But if you had to offer any advice to her, or maybe you have offered advice to her, what would that look like? What would that sound like?
I'm not even sure I would try to encourage her not to move away. I just think I don't want her to leave here thinking, gotta get out of here because Toledo's so awful, because it really isn't. It's just that you have to put effort into changing the experience. Like, if you don't like the experience you had growing up in a suburb, you just have to, like, actively, proactively change that.
We left Allende in Columbus, where Ohio just didn't quite feel like home. After grad school, Allende moved back to New York City. But then he and his partner got the offer of a lifetime for two academics in the humanities from the University of Toledo.
My partner and I were both offered positions in the English department, which is like the holy grail of, like, you know, dual partner hire. Like, if you get that kind of thing, you just have to. And again, I felt for some reason, and I interviewed in many, you know, at many places, and returning to Ohio for a job, even though I had never visited Toledo, but returning to this state felt familiar. I was like, I've been here. It's, you know, like, I was here for 6 years for grad school, and something about Ohio surprisingly felt like home.
And then one key thing changed everything: having a kid.
My sense of home wasn't solidified here until I had my daughter, until we had our daughter. And, you know, she was born at Toledo Hospital, ProMedica. And I feel like, you know, this constant search for home and assigning place to home changed into something else. And I began to think of home not so much in terms of geography, but more so in terms of, like, family and community.
Allende isn't the only one who thinks Toledo is a great place for kids. In our reporting for this podcast, dozens of people have called Toledo family-friendly. But do the stats actually back that reputation up? Only 60% of Toledo's residents are between the ages of 18 and 64. For comparison, nearly every other major American city has a larger proportion of their population within that age range. In New York, it's 63%. In LA and Chicago, it's 67%. In San Francisco, it's 68%. And in Boston, it's 72%. Even other nearby cities like Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati have percentages in the high 60s. The biggest factor in Toledo's percentage is the large population of children living in the city. 26% of Toledo's residents are below the age of 20, which, alongside Columbus, is the highest proportion of any of the cities we just mentioned. In fact, Toledo is such a family-friendly city that kids and teenagers are more common inside city limits than in the suburbs. This is actually quite remarkable, given how virtually every other city in America has the inverse relationship with its surrounding areas. Even as we're focusing on this issue of brain drain, it's worth remembering that, where family friendliness is concerned, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco wish they could be more like Toledo. And Toledo is building on that momentum. In the last decade alone, Metro Parks, the region's public park district, has transformed Toledo's relationship to the riverfront, which might just be the city's oldest and most valuable amenity. Matt Killam is Metro Parks' chief of external affairs.
I used to own bars in the Chicagoland area, and I moved back to raise a family here, be closer to my family, and enjoy what it's like to live in the Midwest. So the Metro Parks didn't drive me back, certainly, but it's made my life better here. I mean, my little girls do play in the same play area that I did. And as an employee, getting to participate in something that makes their community better, it is incredibly fulfilling. I would have probably come back no matter what, right? But this is making a lot better for me, and it is making for a very rewarding life.
Metro Parks was founded in 1928. Much of its infrastructure was built through the New Deal's Works Progress Administration and Civilian Conservation Corps. By 1939, the Metro Parks covered 1,000 acres of land across Lucas County. In 2019, 6 million people visited Lucas County's Metro Parks. The next year, Metro Parks won the National Gold Medal for Excellence in Parks and Recreation Management. By 2020, a Metro Park was within 5 miles of every Lucas County resident. But their largest and most ambitious project was just getting started.
When we were looking at the downtown park, for instance, we benchmarked all over the country. And what we saw just from an economic development standpoint was from every $1 of public money invested in the riverfront, there was a $7 to $20 return in economic development, right? And our little project downtown has seen numbers right in the middle there. So we've been open since 2019, October 2019. So the end of 2019, we've seen over $400 million with their development around it.
Glass City Metro Park is part of a larger effort to develop Toledo's Riverwalk. After years of failed investments and broken promises, the city is finally reconnecting with the Maumee. The abandoned industrial lands along the river are being transformed into 5 miles of connected, multi-use greenway. The Glass City Metro Park itself is set to be complete in its entirety in 8 years. It will feature restored shoreline habitats, as well as playgrounds, a roller and ice skating ribbon, a restaurant, and a scale model of the Maumee for kids to splash around in. Matt said these amenities are top of the list when people consider where they want to live.
6 neighborhoods surround the downtown Metro Park, some of which are the most challenged from amenities and things of that variety of crumbling infrastructure, which is not unique for a town like ours, sort of in a flyover state, if you will. But trails and green space adds to the property value. It is our amenities that almost immediately people check off as things that they find desirable to live near their homes.
Toledo is transforming. Its amenities are thriving, but many young people are still waiting for something more, something that Toledo is working on, but might not have fully figured out yet.
Anavi, you were actually at the Glass City Park in person this past summer, right?
It's a really cool park. It just seemed like a lot of fun. When we went over the summer, there were a lot of little kids there, and it felt like there were a lot of summer camps going on, but there was definitely just a very positive environment.
You only went once. Do you think that you'd want to go back?
I think I would go back if I were visiting Toledo. If I was in Toledo, I would go back to Glass City. But I do think that for someone my age, it's fun to do those things once in a while, but kind of coming back to them, coming back to the ribbon and going around again or climbing up on the same rock wall, swinging on the same swings, they can get a little repetitive and I might want to go look elsewhere, as I imagine is the case for some of the young people in Toledo.
Like Anavi said earlier in this episode, many of the people we interviewed spoke about searching for vibrance. They want a sense of adventure. They want a risk-tolerant, innovative, and curious environment. And these aren't just some abstract qualities that young people like to lay claim to. They also play an integral role in maintaining the urban ecosystem. Research has shown that young people, in part because of their adventurousness, are more likely than their older counterparts to start new businesses, donate to charitable causes, and advocate for social and economic justice within their communities. But at the same time, no city can rely on youthful enthusiasm alone. Toledo doesn't have to shed its family-friendly identity to allow for a younger demographic to take root in the city. Nor should it. After all, in an era when so many people are leaving, why dismiss one of the qualities that has drawn folks to the city and brought former Toledoans home? Here's Allende again.
So I think the city must build on that so that it retains the population, especially the younger population, that has kids. Because there are other cities that have that too, okay? There are other mid-size or, you know, a little larger cities in Toledo that have all those things too, that are really family-friendly, that are affordable, and so on and so forth. It can't just be that, though, right? Because there are different types of families, right? There are families who enjoy shows or enjoy, I don't know, different cultural experiences, like my family, right, who enjoy an intellectual culture, an intellectual space. There are families that enjoy diversity of whatever type, right? So you have, you know, those things have to be available too, I think, for certain families. Because, again, I think that a family-friendly identity solely is, for lack of a better word, it's not that unique, you know? I think that's one thing. I think the city can build on that, and it should, and it is, and continue doing that. At the same time, there are other pockets of identity that should be built as well, you know, in tandem with the family-friendly image. You know, we can do more than one thing, and we should strive for the betterment of all these other pockets, right, in terms of, like, what makes our city Toledo.
So what does make Toledo, Toledo? What are those other pockets that Allende's talking about? If there's anything we've learned from producing this podcast, it's that there are as many different motivations to be in Toledo as there are different kinds of Toledoans. For Molly Lutke, choosing Toledo is about enjoying the chosen family she's surrounded herself with.
That's why the idea of leaving Toledo has never really gone that far for me, because my community, my personal community here is so rich that, like, I can't pick them up and take them all with me. So I don't think it would feel like home to me being somewhere else. I think it'd feel exciting. I think it'd be fun. I think it would do lots of things. What I don't think it would do is feel like home to me.
For Nicole Pfeiffer, choosing Toledo had to do with transforming identities for herself, but also for the city.
There was a time in my life where I probably would have said, like, I'm never going back there. Honestly, there probably was. I know there was, and I'm sure I said it to many people. But that changed, and that changed because I changed, my place in life changed, but also because this place changed.
For Allende, choosing Toledo means choosing a life he would never otherwise have been able to have.
My life would not be the way it is now had I stayed in New York City. I know it. I know for a fact that it wouldn't be the way it is now. So I'm very grateful for choosing to take that leap and, you know, and making this home.
Brain Drain is a mid-story podcast written and hosted by Dea Kukeli and by me, Yannick Schaller. Additional reporting on this episode by Anavi Prakash. Our editors are Logan Sander and Samuel Chang. Sound design and engineering on this episode is by yours truly. Original artwork for the series by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. Data analysis by Tsaisha Tsui, Anna Diasio, and Yitong Jiang. Fact-checking by Terry Brisky. Special thanks go to our lovely team of interns who called Toledo home for at least a summer. Anavi Prakash, Yasu Shinozaki, Rajan Carson, Martin Barreto, and Desiree Lua. For more information, research, and reading material, please check out the show notes for this episode, available at midstory.org/braindrain. If our reporting has struck a chord or a nerve, we want to hear from you. Reach us on social media or via email at braindrain@midstory.org. Thanks for listening.
In In the 19th century, it seemed like everyone wanted to build a railroad. So when train companies started going bankrupt, people had to figure out what to do with the tens of thousands of miles of railroad track that was left behind. Enter the Rails to Trails movement, which turns tracks into recreational trails. Supporters of this 60-year-old effort are pursuing a big goal: the construction of a trail that stretches across America. In the process, helping towns turn their industrial history into outdoor opportunity. More than 150 years after the first transcontinental railroad was completed, reporter Evan Blanco explored the past, present, and future of rail trail conversions. He talks to fellow Celia Johnson about these efforts.
For the past few weeks, I've been researching Rails to Trails, the movement and the organization that is converting thousands of miles of abandoned railroad track into bike trails. It's a really fascinating history, and I think it's really inspiring for how we can reuse this industrial infrastructure, especially in the Midwest.
And what got you interested in reporting on this story?
Yeah, so I grew up in Pittsburgh, and throughout the summers, my family would always go ride on the bike trails. We are on a trail called the Great Allegheny Passage, which actually stretches all the way from Pittsburgh to Cumberland, Maryland. And maybe it was because I was raised in a family of railroad people. For some reason, the bike trails always were associated with railroads in my mind. And I was just thinking, why is that? So I started looking into it. And I discovered this movement called Rails to Trails, which started in the Midwest in the 60s. And it was just this novel idea that we can take this great infrastructure, which, you know, all this work was done to flatten this land, to bore through tunnels and create bridges, that is now just wasted. And that's the perfect opportunity for this public good of a walking trail or a biking trail. And I think it's just such a novel idea that seems obvious now, but it wasn't at the time. And then I found Rails to Trails Conservancy, which is this group that started in the late 80s. And they're kind of the nonprofit which is driving this whole movement. And I can get into that a little bit later.
Well, let's go back in time a little bit and talk about, you know, why were these railroads abandoned in the first place?
So going back to the mid and late 1800s, it's kind of astounding to think about just how important railroads were to American society. Peter Harnick, who is one of the founders of RTC, he compares it to like the tech boom nowadays. Like, the railroads were just so intertwined because it was, you know, you could travel such great distances in, you know, a fraction of the time, which just opened up the economy, opened up so many different aspects of American life. And because of that, the government wanted to help that happen, right? So they were giving away a lot of land grants. They were giving these bonds to railroad companies. And it fueled rampant construction. The incentives were high, and everyone wanted to get in on this huge craze that's gonna, you know, be the next technological innovation. So what ended up happening is there were a lot of redundant routes. One example is from Chicago to New York. There were 9 separate routes. But because everyone wanted their piece of the pie, it happened, particularly in the Midwest and the Northeast. So there were a ton of redundant lines, but unfortunately, building railroads was very expensive, and operating the railroads was also very expensive. So this overbuilding, that doesn't really help operate a railroad any cheaper, and railroads started going bankrupt. It led to a few recessions because it was such an integral part of the economy, and ultimately the Panic of 1893, which just multiplied the railroad failures. And this panic, it pretty much halted construction of the railroads. You know, we had 9,000 miles of track in 1850. The height was, I believe, around 1916 with 254,000 miles of track.
Wow.
But most of it halted after the Panic of 1893. And then, you know, a few decades later, we get automobiles, we get trucks. That siphons away passenger travel, that siphons away freight, and railroads really don't have any other option. Railroads continue to go out of business, and then the rest of them become consolidated. Railroads are one of the most consolidated industries out there. And because of that, we have all this redundant line. It doesn't need to be redundant anymore when there's so little travel going on the rails, but then also it's so consolidated.
So obviously there's a lot of extra track, like you've just described, and you talked a little bit earlier about why railroads might be a good choice for adding trails because, you know, they've already flattened out the land. But, I mean, I imagine that you still have to do some sort of work to convert a railroad line into a trail. So, I mean, what does that process look like?
Yeah, so like I said, a lot of the heavy backbreaking work is already done, but that certainly doesn't mean it's easy. The first thing that they have to do is acquire the land. If a railroad is abandoning a line, they have to put out a notice of abandonment. And that gives, I believe, around 30 days for other railroads to say, no, we'd like to buy this railway corridor for our own service. That doesn't happen very much these days, but that's just a formality they have to do. Well, then after that 30 days, whether that's a group that wants to create a trail, they can acquire the land through a process called rail banking. And then the next step would be funding. You know, there's federal, state, and local, and then, of course, just fundraising to build trails. These are community organizations that are putting this on, so they really have to get money wherever they can. And then organization is the most important thing. You know, this is not companies out there that are doing these trail conversions. It's groups of small towns working on this. And they have to design. They have to make a lot of choices. Do they want it to be paved? Do they want it to be concrete? Do they want it to be crushed stone? When I was growing up, I always preferred paved trails because it was a little bit smoother, but there's costs associated with that. And each of those different options have maintenance, right? And then you also have to think about if there's any tunnels on the routes, if there's bridges that you might have to repair, if you want amenities, and then you have to maintain it all. It is a laundry list of things you have to consider. But that's where the Rails to Trails Conservancy comes in, right? Because they're basically a public resource to help these conversions happen. So they have Facebook groups, they have webinars, they have resource libraries.
So you mentioned the process by which these local groups acquire the railroads is called rail banking. So is that like a permanent process? So once they acquire the land, it's theirs forever?
Yeah, so rail banking is a really interesting aspect of this whole story, and most of these conversions would not have been possible without it. It was created in 1983 by Pete Rayner. It's a preservation policy, right? It wants to keep this land, this flat land, as a great asset, and it doesn't want it to just get divvied up back to the original owners. It preserves the rail corridors for future rail reactivation. Whether that be the railroad wants to come back and reactivate service, or maybe it might be high-speed rail in the future. But it removes the railroad's liability so that it can be used for trails in the interim. That policy, which was an amendment to the 1968 National Trail Systems Act, it has helped convert more than 175 rail trails.
And I imagine, it hasn't all been easy for this project. So what kinds of challenges have, you know, Rails to Trails supporters faced?
Yeah, so I'd say the biggest thing is funding. That is the thing that a lot of projects come down to. Especially in 2025, there's been a lot of federal cuts, unfortunately. Funding was kind of ramped up in the 80s, but it's just kind of taken a back seat now. And as I was saying, with these Western states, there's less redundancy, less abandonment, and less population. So it's kind of harder to connect things out there. But the flip side of that is, even though it is a smaller population, these Western states typically have more of their economy centered around outdoor recreation. So they actually care more about these trails, so there is that motivation there. The third thing that is very difficult is just that you need multiple parties to get on board for this. Whether it's, you know, getting land, you need multiple property owners, or if you're trying to connect a trail network, you need multiple states and multiple counties. It's a bit of a headache. So you just need to get them all on the same page. And that federal role and the federal funding can help with that. But when it's gone, that makes it a lot harder.
Well, let's talk about these networks of trails for a second. I know that the Conservancy is hoping to eventually build, you know, a cross-country bike trail that goes from, you know, the East Coast to the West Coast. So what would be the impact of having a trail like that, you think?
Yeah, so the Great American Rail Trail is kind of their big vision over the next few decades. It will connect from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. And the biggest thing is just the economic impact. They have estimated that it will bring $22 million in visitor spending, $22 million in new tax revenue, over 2,000 new jobs, $104 million in labor income, $161 million in GDP contribution. So the biggest thing with these trails is, yes, you can have the appeal that this is an important outdoor activity. It, you know, connects people to nature and each other, but also there's a big economic incentive. There was the Beltline in Atlanta, which was transformed, and it was $800 million to do it, but it's brought $9 billion in private investment just in Atlanta because all of these companies, you know, want to be on the rail trail, and it's really worked out. But then, you know, there is also the symbolic meaning behind it, right? So the Transcontinental Railroad, it was this big moment of our country is connected, and Rails to Trails kind of sees it that same way. When they announced it, it was on the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad, and it shows people in the whole country that trails matter as a form of transportation. And a few founders were talking about that they really hope that the Great American Rail Trail becomes almost like a rite of passage for every American, that, you know, someday they'll be able to take the entire length and see their great country.
Well, that sounds like it'll be really lovely.
Yeah.
Well, you talked a little bit about earlier, you know, in Western states, a lot of their economy is centered around this outdoor recreation. So that's a big part of their identity. You know, how do you think that rail trails play into the identity of the Midwest? Obviously, we're sitting here in Northwest Ohio right now.
Eric, who I talked to, he said, you know, unless you're on the Great Lakes, you don't have a ton of natural features in the Midwest, but you do have an abundance of abandoned rail lines that you can convert to these trails. And he's seen a lot of cities in the Midwest are kind of redefining themselves around these trails and defining themselves as trail cities. So in a lot of these small towns that have been, you know, hollowed out when manufacturing left and when the trains left, these trails have kind of become almost like new main streets for these Rust Belt towns. And it's just been really great to see. He said that because of the Midwest, you have very rural places and then you have small urban places. So it's got some of the best connectivity in the country, and you can start in the city, go into the rural areas, and then come back. And you just don't get that in a lot of other parts of the country. You know, if you go on a trail in New York City, you're only going to see the city. And then Brandy Horton was the other person from RTC who I was talking to, and she's from the city. But she went on a trail ride in the Midwest, and they were riding along the trail, and she said that it was soybean harvesting season. And she saw just this great field of soybeans and was just almost brought to tears just because it's so beautiful, and you don't think about these states, but, you know, there is beauty there that when you're going at that human speed or the speed of a bike, when you're not flying over it or driving through the Midwest, you can really appreciate that.
Yeah, it really gives you a chance to experience the Midwest.
Yeah.
All right, well, great. Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you for coming in and speaking about your story.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Just outside of Cleveland, the Mill Creek watershed is home to a host of stories. In Warrensville Heights, residents facing erosion and flooding must choose whether to participate in a buyout of houses by a local nonprofit. In Maple Heights, a tree planting program proves more controversial than expected. And across the region, rewilding, an alternative to traditional landscaping, begins to take root. Fellow Yannick Schaller and a team of interns dug into the many ways in which Mill Creek residents are reconnecting with their watershed. In conversation with fellow Evan Blanco, Schaller discusses the process of reporting on this story and hearing directly from the residents it impacts. Here's their conversation.
My work on the Mill Creek feature started all the way back in December of 2024. And this was a long project, so the research and reporting and writing efforts stretched all the way into the fall of this last year.
That's great. So what got you interested in the story?
I have a background in environmental science. My undergraduate degree is in environmental science. This is a story that combines the community's relationship with their built environment and their relationship with their natural environment and how those interactions have changed and shifted over the years. I'm also really interested in reporting that can kind of stretch beyond the page, as it were, reporting that can also incorporate community feedback and community guidance directly into the creative process. And from the very get-go here, we were interested in seeing if our Mill Creek reporting could lend itself directly to the Mill Creek communities and the Mill Creek watershed in southeastern Cleveland.
So let's take a step back. What's the history of the Mill Creek watershed? How did it become polluted and built up?
Definitely. So Mill Creek is a relatively minor tributary of the Cuyahoga River. It winds its way through a handful of communities in southeastern Cleveland before emptying into that larger river. And it's had a pretty kind of central place in the development of the greater Cleveland area. It was a passageway that was initially developed through the railroads. The railroad itself actually still runs along the creek. But that connection between transportation and commerce and the natural environment rapidly put a lot of pressure on the integrity of the natural mm-hmm. environment. We see Mill Creek Falls, actually, which is a pretty impressive set of waterfalls that dot the creek. They were actually physically relocated to make room for the railway when it was first being built. And this is still a crazy feat of engineering to me. And this happened over 100 years ago. Over the course of the 20th century, we just kind of see an increasing amount of pressure being placed on the ecosystem there. Whereas previously it had been pretty heavily forested and green, the Mill Creek watershed is now over 90% paved. And we also see a lot of encroachment, people getting closer and closer to the banks of that river, eating up that sort of buffer zone that exists or should exist typically between a river habitat and a residential one. And I think the last and really most kind of interesting aspect for me in this transformation is that people generationally became less and less connected to the river itself. There really isn't a whole lot of sentimental attachment to this environment. The response more often than not is kind of one of hostility, I'd say. Sometimes it registers as fear too. This is an environment that represents a threat to the homes and businesses because it is no longer well regulated, it is no longer well maintained. And for instance, when things like flood events occur, they can really do a number on the homes and businesses that people really protect and value. Of course, they must. Those are their lives and livelihoods there. And where the river used to be a source of recreation, a source of enjoyment, kind of a point of pride for the community, in the process of being kind of like constrained and confined, it's almost become a little bit of a threat to the community.
Can you go a little deeper into the specific problems that needed to be solved that you reported on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the kind of impetus for the project, I would say, is again tied back not necessarily to the softer, kind of more abstract relationship with the environment, but more so with the way that people are actively losing ground, quite literally, to the river. A lot of people have had to deal with floodwaters rising into their basements, into their homes over the last few years, and also have had to deal with things like erosion. Their properties now abut directly onto the creek are kind of getting eaten away piece by piece because there isn't that buffer zone that I mentioned earlier anymore. And what the Regional Sewer and Water District have done and what West Creek have done to sort of begin to mitigate and adapt to this issue is physically reconfigure the river to restore that watershed, to kind of build back that buffer zone. And those are some pretty wide-ranging strategies, everything from physically reshaping the environment along some stretches of the river to even picking up and moving properties away from the river itself. There's one block, essentially, in Warrensville Heights on Cricket Lane, and Mill Creek winds its way behind a row of houses on that street, and some people on that block have lived there for decades now. And West Creek identified, in collaboration with the Regional Sewer and Water District, that these properties were at immediate risk, that it wasn't simply a matter of like losing the edges of their land to the river in the coming years, but rather that their properties might become, you know, complete losses.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely crucial that they buy up these properties and convert them, kind of like turn them from residential zones into non-inhabited buffer areas, like I mentioned before, for the creek. And that's a very delicate process, of course. So we spoke with Derek Schaefer from West Creek Conservancy. He's the person that kind of led the charge on the buyouts and is very important. He stressed to us that these were voluntary. There was never any sort of coercive tactics being used. He simply was very persistent. He showed up in person. He knocked on doors in this stretch of neighborhood and simply talked about what the problem was and what could be done. And over time, trust was established, and all but one of the impacted properties agreed, those homeowners agreed to sell to West Creek. They saw that it wasn't all that likely that they would receive a better offer on their properties than the one that they were receiving from West Creek. These were fair assessments of the value of the land, fair, even more than fair, given that a lot of damage had been done over time from the river. And so West Creek is now in the final stages, well, kind of preparatory stages, of laying out the kind of rehabilitation strategy.
Well, I remember when you were working on the story last summer with our intern cohort, when we were in Cleveland, you went to a listening event during the summer. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that it was really important to me and to the rest of the reporting team on this project that the work that we did was in service of the community. So I, back last spring, got in touch with this wonderful human being named Kim Woodford. She runs a nonprofit group called Journey on Yonder, or JOY for short. Her mission is largely dedicated to getting people of color and lower income people out into the outdoors to sort of build back some of that connection, some of that understanding. She graciously agreed to serve as the mediator for our listening session. And then last summer, we actually made it all happen. We went out there. We had prepped extensively with Kim. We had a series of questions and prompts for discussion. We had a modest but very engaged and interested set of community members who showed up on that day. We also had a member of the Northeast Ohio Regional Water District on hand to go into a bit more detail on the various efforts that are underway to kind of restore and protect the watershed. I think it was great for a lot of these folks to have the chance to ask a physical human being directly questions about what was going on, as opposed to having to show up to city council meetings or having to kind of make sense of mailers that they would receive. That was the clear and concise communication that many of these residents felt that they had been lacking.
Well, that's great to hear. And what still has to be done?
So when we last checked in with the folks on the ground in Cleveland in the fall, they were still sort of waiting for a few loose ends to be tied up. They were actually in conversation with the electric utility that serves the community, because some of the electric wiring and poles need to be relocated and decommissioned before the complete, you know, removal of these properties and the rehabilitation of that tract of land in Warrensville Heights could begin. But they were expecting that to really kick into full gear this year in 2026. Many of the other restoration efforts across the watershed have either already been completed. One of those includes a lovely renovation of the Garfield Park Reservation. And we actually had a few interviews that took place in the reservation at that park last spring. And that was wonderful to see. It was a lively atmosphere even that early in the season. People were out and about, really kind of making use of the space, enjoying it as they saw fit. I think kind of in tandem with the sort of capital investments made by folks from the water district to mitigate the adverse effects of having that kind of more direct relationship with your natural environment, it seems like things are really on the right track in Cleveland.
That's great. Well, I'm sure the story is not unique to just Cleveland. I'm sure there's many Mill Creek type situations all across the region and the country, and hopefully Mill Creek can set an example for how we are restoring these watersheds.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Mid-Story Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Mid-Story, our home and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. Mid-Story Hour is a Mid-Story podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Samuel Chang, edited by Evan Blanco, and written by Logan Sander, Ruth Chang, and Samuel Chang. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Repp. This week's episode features stories by the Greater Mid-Story team, including Dea Kukeli, Yannick Schaller, Celia Johnson, and Yaffa Siegel. Mid-Story is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Mid-Story re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.